And I've just stepped off my slightly oversized motorbike at the NEC, the National Exhibition Centre, probably one of the largest exhibition centres in the United Kingdom, and it's smack bang in the middle of the United Kingdom at Birmingham. I'm here for the outdoor show. It's a large event for outdoor enthusiasts, all indoors, three huge halls, and a little bit outside where I can see a small tent city which is cropped up. Looks a bit like a load of refugees, but I think it's just people trying to sell tents. I just thought I'd pop around and have a look what's going on in the world of outdoors. I do love my outdoor shops, being a keen kind of hitchhiker, walker, camper, but mostly bushcraft. I love a bit of bushcraft, which I guess to those not in the know could be called survival. I hope to speak to a few bushcrafters. It's really windy, so I should probably go inside because I can hear this on the mic. Right, well, I'm inside the show. I arrived here in a bit of a fluster because as I went into the press office to get my credentials, I suddenly discovered I'd been given the wrong time for a talk by the great Ray Mears, bushcrafter, survival expert extraordinaire. So I ran as much as a person can run in a crowded hall with stalls every 2 feet and people walking half a mile an hour over to the other side. Managed to blag my way in. I need tickets and they don't normally let people in after these things start. And got some photos, which if you're viewing the Enhanced podcast, you can see a couple now. Ray Mears, of course, famous in the UK and possibly other places for his DVDs, his TV shows and his books. Thought to be the top bushcrafter, he's the most popular bushcrafter in the world, I think. He's got an amazing reputation. It comes across, I must admit, he comes across a little bit smug on telly, but to see him talk now, it just seems really, really genuine. And when he's talking about some of these old bushmen and old survival experts that he's come into contact with, be it Australia, Africa or Mongolia, when a photo comes up and it's someone who's no longer with us and sadly died, he looks like he's about to burst into tears. He's really passionate about what he's doing. And a really, really important point that he made, a really important point, and it was that bushcraft is not about gleaning skills and collecting loads of skills and sticking badges on your arm, firelighting this and hunting that. It's about getting out and enjoying nature. It's about being a part of your environment and being a part of nature. And I think that is really important, because as much as I see bushcraft as a way of enhancing my skills as an individual, it is all about getting out there. And when you wake up at dawn under a leaky shelter and you've got some moss and a mushroom for breakfast, or whatever it is you've foraged for, you can't beat the feeling, to be honest. You're there right in the middle of it. No real luxuries to separate yourself from experiencing life. Yeah, fantastic. Lovely guy.
Listen to Documentary.
Okay, in amongst the hustle and bustle is, you can hear Irish music. There are all kinds of stalls from all kinds of people promoting the great outdoors and trying to get people out and about. I couldn't help but stop at this huge wall of writing, almost like, here's a blank wall, here's a pen, go and graffiti your favourite walk, put where you would much rather walk than anywhere else, on the wall for everybody to see. And this seems to be the brainchild. It's called the Walking Wall. It seems to be the brainchild of John from HF Holidays. Where did this idea come from?
The idea, I believe, actually came from the organisers. We can't claim that this is an original idea of ours, but we bought into it. We thought it was an absolutely brilliant idea. It's a chance for everybody to play the graffiti artist. Everybody's coming up, not hesitating to pick up the pen and write whatever they want. There's some pretty creative artwork on there. And one or two witticisms. We've got, what can we see? One person's put to the pub after a long day on any hill. Loads of places all over the UK. Corsica, GR20, Triven, Wales, Everest Base Camp. It just shows you know, the breadth of experience of people coming to the show. It's fantastic. It's been really successful for us.
I think some people are showing off as well. Everest Base Camp. My favourite walk was the walk to a pub, believe it or not. It used to be kind of a back hidden pathway that I used to do every night with my friends, and it was just a little piece of countryside in a small town I used to live. So I guess if I had to think of a favourite walk, it's not super outdoorsy, but it was the walk to the pub, much like a lot of people have said.
People have got an emotional attachment to these things. It's not necessarily the best countryside. What else have we got there? We put somebody's mentioned that they got married halfway up Snowdon. What else have we got? The walk between Bridlington to Sewerby. Well, not my idea of the best. My own personal one is probably a backpacking trip I did once from Inverew to Avetian, which is up in the Fisherfield Forest, Northwest Highlands. Absolutely fantastic, totally remote, on one of those rare occasions where we had unbroken sunshine from dawn to dusk. It was midsummer, sun didn't go down till gone 11. It was absolutely amazing.
Oh, you've given me time to think now. You've given me time to think. Mine now has to be, I've relegated my pub and walk to position number two. My favourite walk ever was the walk to work, when I used to work as a pastore, they called it, pastoral personal shepherd, in the Ticino area of the Swiss Alps.
Oh, wow.
It was 6 hours to get to a village. But I used to walk up and down this village, and I was in charge of, even though I was called a shepherd, I was actually in charge of 37 head of cattle. And in the months I was there, I only saw people once, and they were lost walkers. But it was just incredible. And one of the benefits of being in total isolation was you didn't have to wear any clothes. And because you didn't need pockets for money or anything. So I'd have my dog and a kind of walking staff. And occasionally I could be seen, I can say stark bollock, naked.
That's really quite cool. I'm lucky enough to live in the North Pennines, and I could probably get away with that. I've walked in our local hills for 20 years, and I could count the number of people I've seen on one hand. But the weather's not quite what it is in Switzerland, so I don't think I'll be trying that one.
So tell me about the company behind this, HF Holidays. Personally, I'd never heard of it.
No, some people would say we're a well-kept secret, but we've actually been around for a very, very long time. We're one of the oldest established companies of its kind in the country. These days, we operate all over the UK. We've got our own nice, comfortable country house hotels in most of the national parks, from as far north as Glencoe. I know that's not a national park, but Glencoe, down through the Lake District, Northumberland, North Wales, South Wales, down to Cornwall, and we operate walking holidays, either guided holidays or self-guided holidays, which are very sociable affairs. Groups of people get together, have a good time, good food, choice of walks every day, and then we extend that concept and we do it in Europe. We go to all the popular alpine resorts, some places off the beaten track, and long haul stuff too. So the most popular thing we do, for example, long haul is New Zealand. So Peru, Everest trekking, you know what we do.
Wow, you do everything. Okay, for my international audience, which I'm lucky enough to have, hopefully they're still there listening, with the few podcasts I've done recently, it's been a bit surreal. If somebody from my international audience was to come to the UK specifically to walk, where is the one place that you would recommend them go to?
Personally, and it has to be a personal point of view, because my view genuinely is that everywhere has got its own attractions, Personally, I'm into the mountains. I would go to our place in Glencoe because it's got... For people coming from abroad, they're often very surprised at the freedom of access that we've got to the hills. And it doesn't take too much effort to get to the tops of mountains and mountains wherever you are in the world. And the views from the tops on a good day are absolutely fantastic. They'll compare with anything else in the world. It's a wonderful place.
And that's in Scotland, of course, Glencoe. So how do you feel about kind of our wilderness and our expanses compared to someone that might come from Canada? Would you say we're getting to be a kind of an enclosed country and we're losing a lot of our wildlife?
I think that we're doing well to protect what we've got. Wilderness is a relative term. These spaces are so precious to people who live in the UK that we're going to do everything that we can to keep them as wilderness areas. And, you know, I genuinely believe that, you know, the mountain environment is a mountain environment. And it doesn't matter whether you're, on, you know, on top of a mountain in Canada or in Scotland, the experience is very similar. And like I say, I think you'll find that a lot of people from overseas, and I have spoken to Canadians who said exactly this, that they come and they're amazed at the freedom of access that we've got to wander around the mountains, and that's a really precious heritage. They don't necessarily have that freedom in places like Canada. The scenery is awesome, absolutely fantastic, but you can't necessarily get to everywhere that you want to go.
And plus, we have the added advantage of not being eaten by bears.
Only midges on occasions in Scotland.
Oh, I've just seen an amazing guy selling a totally natural midge repellent. He's up the top there. Oh, it sounds fantastic. Oh, the Irish dancers are kicking into full swing. I'd like to say thank you very much, John. I really appreciate the time talking to you. I'm going to head off and go and check out some of the people. Excuse me.
Excuse me.
Gordon Bennett. I'll tell you, if you want to get to the toilet in a hurry in this place...
Well, you're not going to get to the toilet in a hurry.
Here we go. Okay, now this is what we're talking about. This was the area of the show that I really wanted to check out. I'm in the bushcraft section. I'm actually in a tent. A beautiful kind of Scandinavian teepee style tent that are really expensive, otherwise I'd probably have one. I just caught the end of a talk, absolutely fantastic and interesting talk on animal tracks by, dare I say, the famous Ian Maxwell. He seems to be pretty famous. Loads of people were really interested and asking for book signings afterwards. And I've managed to corner Rhoda McGiven, that's correct, and who's a tracker with Ian's company, Shadowhawk. There's going to be a lot of people listening to this that don't necessarily know anything about tracking. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do, what Shadowhawk do for people in the UK, and kind of how popular the whole thing is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we do a lot of wildlife tracking. We teach the general public, we teach some military organisations, all sorts of people, anti-poaching organisations, wildlife wardens, anybody basically who's interested in learning how to track both animals and man tracking as well. We do a lot of anti-poaching work. Specifically, we teach search and rescue teams to look for missing people. All types of tracking, really. Anything that's got feet will follow it.
That's fantastic. So you say you teach the military. What would they want to be mostly tracking people?
Yeah, it's Max, more than me, runs tactical tracking courses, mainly abroad, but it's done some things in this country, just helping to train people, tracking techniques, because he's got a military background himself, so he's really specialised in that sort of tracking.
Max is from South Africa, I believe. Is that right?
He's from Zambia, yeah.
Okay, probably a common mistake that's made. Yeah, I couldn't help but notice an accent when he was talking. He's off book signing at the moment. No doubt he's got a queue about a mile long because the whole place is packed today. How important is keeping the skills of tracking alive?
Oh, it's really important. It's vital. I mean, like Max has said in the talk, there's within every man, woman and child lies a tracker. Anybody can do it. We're a bit controversial for saying that. a lot of people seem to think that it's a mystical art, and you know, you've got to do your lifelong apprenticeship to be able to track anything, but anybody can track, and it's just about keeping that spirit alive within people today, because we run around you know, with our heads in the clouds, and really to just connect with nature, to connect with what's going on in the woods, what's going on around you, is just the best way of doing it.
I was just about to say that. I mean, you can quite easily just go for a walk in the woods, but until you get down on your hands and knees and smell and feel and touch and really get into your surroundings, you're not really going to be a part of the environment, are you? It's incredible. The most amazing tracks I think I've ever seen are the tracks of... They're very rude looking. I wonder if you can guess. No. I think it was called a snowshoed hare.
Okay, yeah, I know what you mean, yep. Yeah.
If you get a chance, just Google snowshoe hare tracks. You should come up with a picture. The weirdest animal tracks I've ever seen. I thought someone had been graffitiing phallic objects in the snow, shall we say. Just incredible. How long does it take to become a competent tracker?
Well, you know, it varies. Some people are naturally really good at it, and it'll take them, you know, literally an hour, a few minutes even, and they've got it, and they're off and running with it. But anybody, I'd say within a weekend, you know, you've got the basics, and you'll be seeing tracks, and the whole of the woods will be opened up to you. You really know what you're doing, I think.
Well, I've actually, I'm enthralled. So I've picked up a book, Animal Tracks, ID and Techniques, written by Ian Maxwell, and it's a really, really well laid out book. Some great photos, illustrations, obviously diagrams, pictures of the tracks you should be looking for. But you also do courses, like you say. Do you want to give your website a brief plug so people from around the world can check out what you do?
Yeah, sure. It's shadowhawk.co.uk, and we run all sorts of courses in the UK. We run courses in Portugal, in India, tiger tracking. We do Tanzania, Kenya. I think we're running a course in Finland this year. We're doing, you know, bear tracking. We've done Canada. But we do a lot of weekend courses based in Devon, just open to the general public. Anybody can come along and learn how to track.
Say, for instance, I'm bored one Sunday. I live quite close to a forest. I want to head in there and do some tracking. Give me a couple of tips on how I can track, find and recognise animals.
Okay, well, the main thing to think about is that animals will always take a path of least resistance. And if you go for a walk through the woods, you'll see that there's several trails or runs that made by various different animals. If you follow along a trail or a run, you know, a pathway through the vegetation, you probably come across something that we find, we're called a track trap, which is generally maybe a muddy puddle, a patch of mud, something. If you go and look around a farm gate, you know, where there's lots of mud and animals have been coming and going, you'll definitely be able to see some sort of sign of animals having passed through that way. So then if you just grab yourself a decent field guide, which can help you to recognise what you're looking at, have a good look, and I'm sure you'll find something.
Brilliant. I'm going out straight away. I think I've seen mouse traps, tracks around here, actually. Well, I think these are really important skills, and I'm so glad that your organisation, business, is keeping things alive. I'd like to thank you very much, Rhoda, and say please enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Well, there's a stroke of luck. Just passing back through the bushcraft area, I've bumped into the man himself, Ian Maxwell. You're the author of the book. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, I wrote a book called Animal Tracks, ID and Techniques, which was basically designed to include the big cats that are roaming the UK, so the puma, the leopard, etc. It's the first field ID book that actually contains any of these tracks in the UK.
I got to the talk just at the very end. What kind of personal contact have you had yourself?
Well, I've got very close indeed to it, and I've seen it once or twice, but actually confirming that it's there is another thing, because it's highly elusive. Obviously, it can go to ground very quickly. So what I try to do is, I'm working on a program right now, is to get to where the track's going to arrive to, rather than actually chasing after it. So I want to be where its lair is when it arrives back home.
So when you're shooting for a series at the moment, then?
Yeah, I'm doing a couple of series at the moment, one which I can't talk about too much, because it's a contentious issue, the leopards and cats roaming the UK.
Oh, it's just fantastic. I don't know what I'd do if I'd saw a wild cat, but now I've got your book, I'm going to be out looking as well. If I was to see a wild cat and it looked pretty happy and it wasn't really killing too many farm animals, should I keep it to myself?
Well, that's a question I'm often asked, as people say, should we trap it and put it into a zoo? Should we make it a freak show? Should we take it off and do blood tests, etc.? And I've come to terms with that process. And what I'd like to see done is, if it's caught, is it to have a radio collar fitted to it so we can track it with satellite. And that way we get to know a lot more about the cat. It's not just a freak show.
Oh, fantastic. Well, it sounds to me, I'd much rather there be more wild animals roaming the country anyway. It can get a bit boring out there sometimes just looking at the pheasant and the foxes. Quick question before you go, because I know you're in a lot of demand at the moment. Say, for instance, I didn't want to be tracked. Someone like you has been hired. How would I get away from you?
I knew you were going to ask that very tricky question. Well, the thing is, you can't get away, because when I'm on your ass and chasing you, there is no getting off the hook. Once I'm there, that's it. It might take days, it might take weeks. I might not even eat or drink for 3 or 4 days. So the ways that people think they can get away from me, by walking backwards or going through water or walking on stones, none of those actually ever work.
Even in stilettos?
Even in stilettos, even more likely you won't get away from you.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading the book, and I'm going to be checking out the website. We've already spoke about your courses. I wish you all the luck with the series. I can't wait to see it. I understand it's going to be on Sky, but you'll no doubt be able to download a few clips from YouTube in the near future.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much. Take care.
Cheers.
What a lovely man. Yeah, great stuff. I'm very impressed with the kind of people you can meet at the outdoor show. There are some incredible people here with some incredible knowledge. There's also a lot of people selling tat. There's some amazing gadgets, from skidoos to yachts, mini yachts, obviously. Actually, take that back, it's a boat, don't know what I'm talking about. Climbers, cavers, canoeists. Like I say, the bushcraft is a side of things that's interesting me. I'm going to try and find some more people to talk to.
You are listening to Documentally.com. Documenting the mind.
Okay, testing 1, 2. I've had a walk around. My legs are killing. In fact, I've been walking around for the last 8 hours. It feels like 8 hours. I've managed to get back to the bushcraft area, the place where I feel most comfortable. I'm back in the tent, and I've managed to corner Simon Eller, who is the editor of Bushcraft Magazine. Simon, can I tell you, I have been reading your magazine from issue 1, which I believe was last year, wasn't it?
Indeed, yes. Last year we were here launching ourselves. Just getting a bit of brand awareness, putting our name out, and here again this year with a much bigger feature, issue 2, anniversary issue.
You remarkably chilled out, relaxed, kind of, for an editor, for a magazine, you look like you've just come back from a week's camping, not in the rough, unshaven camp look, although there is a hint of that there, but you don't look like a magazine editor. What's your background? Have you worked on other publications before Bushcraft Magazine?
Basically, I've always been in the marketing arena, which is really my strength that I bring with it. And then that switched over into print prior to this. And then, obviously, we saw a need in the market. I've always had an interest in bushcraft. I've been involved with bushcraft type activities since I was about 8. And that's something that I've grown up with and really enjoyed. And we just thought that it's a great way to convey that knowledge to other people and to really sort of bring it out into the forefront.
You seem to be kind of the only serious publication on the market at the moment regarding bushcraft. I remember reading a magazine called Combat and Survival years and years ago, which is where I used to get my kind of outdoorsy, which knife is good for doing this, that and the other information from. Do you have any competition?
I myself too used to get Combat and Survival. I remember buying the very first issue of that. The slant there was that there's more of a military approach and information to it, which is great. We wanted to come out with something that was accessible to all, that's kind of got a family orientated feel. So we've obviously got family activities in the magazine. We've got the Women in the Wild section, but still covering all the core subjects: wild food, knives and axes, fire lighting, and so on. I think we were the UK's first bushcraft magazine, and really, obviously we're the only one here, the only one that really is out there being pushed.
I caught a talk by the inventor of the Shiwi, an amazingly inspirational woman. You were talking about women in the wild. She developed a plastic device that enables women to wee while standing up. I thought that was incredible, and that was one of your lectures here, one of your talks here. What other kind of people have you had here giving invaluable information about what they do, what they sell, or courses they run?
Samantha, she invented the Shiwi. We did one of the first Women in the Wild articles, compared and sort of educated women on that option, and compared those three devices available. She was invited in to speak as part of the Women in the Wild talk that we had here. We've had Ian Maxwell from Shadowhawk, renowned for tracking. He's been on Sky, on the television, and so on. He's been doing talks here on animal tracking and his new book, Animal Techniques and ID. Dave Watson, who is renowned as the leading expert in the field on fire lighting, friction fire lighting, he's been here with us. Andrew Price, Mike Armstrong from Bushtruck, Andrew Price from Dryad, he's been here with the water feature, demonstrating Milbank bags and filters and such.
You've just had so much on, it's been a full programme. Let me ask you about bushcraft in general. What does it mean to you?
Means to me, basically just kind of getting out there and being at one with nature, really appreciating your surroundings and kind of appreciating where things come from. It's all very well to go to a supermarket and buy meat off the shelves and vegetables off the shelves and things. If you think back to how our ancestors would have actually shopped, if you like, and eaten. We run a Nature's Hardware piece in the magazine, which kind of gives a bit of a view on that. And obviously there's the wild foods and things, but it's just really going back and looking at, I guess in some ways, removing modern technology, but using technology to sort of make that a comfortable experience. So yes, we do use tents, we use knives and equipment. On the flip side, we do use flint knives and things at different times too.
It's been amazing to see so many children here today, lighting fires with sparks, comfortably using blades under supervision, and fire lighting equipment in what is an indoor arena. And there not being any issues, seeing their face when they light fire from a spark. It's got to be quite rewarding to come to events like this and not just be stuck in the office editing and putting together the magazine.
Sure, I mean, the children side, you mentioned children there, to see their faces when they get a flame or just doing things if they're trying to filter water or whatever it is. Children really love and respond to bushcraft, and it is a great avenue for them to follow.
I just totally believe we should be spending more time out in nature and less in front of our consoles or our computer games or our computers in general. I had so much fun as a kid, before bushcraft was called bushcraft, just being out there and, you know, trapping grass snakes or tracking muntjac, building dens, and I just think this whole movement, whether or not it falls under the umbrella brand of bushcraft, is something really good to be a part of and really great fun doing it. If there was people out there in the international audience that would be keen on getting more information, other than your website, which is bushcraftmagazine.com, where else do you recommend people going that want to know more about bushcraft so they can get out and do it?
There's a great deal of sources, really. Colleges are now starting to run courses linked with bushcraft or including bushcraft. Local authorities are now beginning to promote bushcraft courses. There's a lot of they class as challenging behaviour groups, that they're finding bushcraft is really a good therapy and a good way of getting them to integrate and to just sort of develop socially. There's a number of forums available that you can go and look at, find information out about bushcraft. Obviously, bushcraft magazines, our magazine. Really, there's sort of a wealth of companies. If you have a look on the internet, if you Google bushcraft, you can find a number of companies that'll offer courses, both in this country, overseas. It's generally tends to be classed more as survival skills if you're going overseas. It's really, bushcraft is really a sort of British branding, if you like. In America, it's more referred to as survival skills and such, but certainly, I mean, we get subscribers from across the world. You name it, really. We've got European, New Zealand, America, Canada.
It's definitely an excellent part of the outdoor world, and the main reason why I wanted to hang around here more than the very expensive clothing departments, which seem to be cropping up everywhere. Half of me is sad it's turning into such a huge kind of multinational business, but it seems to me to be lots of little companies and almost people working on their own, offering the services and the skills to other people. What would be the first thing that you would tell somebody to learn if they wanted to start going out and practicing bushcraft? What's one of the most important skills?
I would say one of the most important things, given I've seen a lot of people go out and take a new interest, if you like, and everybody seems to want to do one of two things. It's either something with a fire or something with a knife, and I think that kind of stems back to our old hunter-gatherer type mentality. You know, in days gone by, they were both integral and really important parts. I would say practice some knife skills. Buying a knife, you don't have to spend a lot of money on a knife. Frostmourne knives are around about a £10 mark. Very good knife. You can learn adequately with that. A lot of instructors use them on their courses. And basically just either get someone to instruct you, go on a course, just get some really good knife instruction. From that, you can then go on to all sorts of skills, because you'll use the knife to make feather sticks for your fire lighting. You'll use the knife to craft things for your camp craft. So it's really, that's sort of a fundamental basic, I would say.
In the general world out there, the knife is a terribly underrated tool, other than we use it in our kitchen, and you'll see it on the news because of some crime involving a knife. I personally cannot state how important I think the knife is in general society, as much as in the outdoor world. I've always carried a knife as a tool, and I use it multiple times every day. I think it's even saved my life once when I got caught on the back of a vehicle by my camera strap and had to cut myself free. And I think anything that promotes the careful, skillful use of a knife in today's society, when we just seem to have negative press everywhere, is absolutely excellent. Listen, Simon, I know you've got to get off and do other things. You've got a whole new day of this tomorrow. God knows where you get the energy from. I want to thank you very much for spending a little bit of time talking to us about your magazine and what you're doing for the bushcraft community in general. I hope people check out the website at bushcraftmagazine.com, and I'm definitely going to be doing some more podcasts. Maybe I could do one just on knives. Maybe I could do a couple just on bushcraft. I hope to be talking to you again in the future, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks very much.
Smushing, that's great. Enjoy talking to you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it. The crowds are subsiding. Listen how quiet it is now. I can actually walk between the stands. I'm going to head back to where I've left my jacket and my helmet and my motorbike, and probably head for home, thinking all the time about some of the really cool people I've met here today. I wish I'd recorded more of the conversations I've had. I hope you've had a nice kind of insight into, well, I guess it would be an outdoor show, but more importantly, bushcraft. I'm seriously thinking of doing an introduction and a proper kind of feature on it in the future. And there you have it, end of the day. So, a long drive home, but a nice time to reflect in my helmet on everything that I have learnt and seen. Thanks very much for listening. You are, as ever, listening to documentally.com, And of course, my name is Christian, and I'll catch up with you guys soon. Cheers.
Okay, I'm back at home, and I just wanted to give. I just want to give this tea bag some water initially. I'm going to enjoy a nice cup of tea, but I also just wanted to give a couple of thanks and a couple of shout outs at the end of the podcast. Firstly, I guess I should thank Bushcraft Magazine people, thank them for their cooperation and allowing me to drag them aside during a very busy day. I definitely would like to thank my server space provider. There's a guy called Giles who has a company called Kyo Internet, K-Y-O Internet. And you can find him at kyoi.net. That's www.kyoi.net. Now, without Giles, this podcast would most likely not exist. It's kind of very much self-funded. I'd like to thank the two people that have donated in the past, but it comes out of my own pocket, and I'm always a little bit short, shall we say. So as a form of sponsorship, Giles is very, very, very flexible. He's a big supporter of new media and was possibly the first person to put me onto podcasts, actually. Once I realised that he was passionate about the whole thing, I thought there must well be a market out there, even though it's not the kind of market that I'm involved in on a monetary level. If he's listening to them, other people are listening to them, let's give it a go. So thanks very much to Giles and kyoi.net. I'd also like to give a plug to the Progressive Podcast Network, of which I've been a part of for quite a while, and really enjoy the support and feedback, and basically the being a part of a group of people with similar interests and similar ideals, and maybe even a similar political slant. It's very, very much based over the water in the States and around the area at the moment. So if there are any British podcasters or European podcasters or Australian podcasters or any podcasters from anywhere else in the world that would like to join the Progressive Podcast Network, or if you're just interested in knowing what they're all about, you can go to theprogressivepodcastnetwork.org, and if nothing else, definitely go to the forum, full of fascinating topics and information, which is based at newmediarevolutionaries.com. You don't have to wear a beret to visit that particular forum, but you definitely need to arrive with an open mind. Excellent. Thanks again for listening to this podcast. Don't forget, until I find the way of kind of making a living or at least being able to fund podcasts through what I'm doing without, I guess, selling out or going corporate, please feel free to donate by visiting documentally.com. Click to enter the site and you'll see a donate button on the right. I've got some semi-big projects involving a little bit of travelling coming up soon, so anything you can give would be appreciated. I would like to say, anybody that does donate, I haven't put anything in practice yet, but I'd like to give them a little something. It might be a sticker or something in the post, should you make a donation. So feel free to go ahead, leave your address if you want me to send you something in the post. And I hope to catch you on the next podcast and that you continue to subscribe and tell everybody you know. Thanks again. Speak to you soon. I'm going to enjoy my lovely cup of tea. Cheers.